Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service, or if you're listening via our website 989fm.com.au, or on our podcast a bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company. Last week, Clancestry kicked off in the Queensland Performing Arts Centre in South Bank in Brisbane, and it's sort of an annual event which brings together mob from all around the country, well, mostly Queensland, I guess. But they always stage a series of conversations. So we're going to play for you today one of those conversations that kicked off on Thursday, and it was around the subject of blacktivism. So it involves Uncle Gary Foley, from legendary land rights activist from New South Wales, but who lives in Melbourne. He's a historian. Aunty Gracelyn Smallwood from Townsville. Luke Pearson of Indigenous X fame. He actually founded the Indigenous X Twitter account and is sort of branching out into online Aboriginal media to sort of expand what he's learnt from Indigenous X. And also myself. And it's been sort of curated by Chelsea Bond, who's a regular guest on our show, and also facilitated by Lisa Wadigo, who actually guided the conversation. So the conversation is all around blacktivism. So not only Aboriginal media, the past Aboriginal media, the future Aboriginal media, but also the role of activism in media and the role of activism more generally, just in Aboriginal affairs more generally, and where sort of our elders like Gary Foley and Aunty Gracelyn see it going, but also where our younger generation sees it going. So it was a very interesting conversation, and we're going to play it for you now. It starts with the words of Chelsea Bond, who is introducing the talk.
My name is Chelsea Bond, and my mob of Mananjali and South Sea through the Williams and Wadigo families. I'm also a Nurukan Research Fellow with QUT's Indigenous Studies Research Network, and in this capacity I've had the privilege of curating the Clancestry Conversation series. In tonight's conversation, we get to critically examine black activism in this country, and in particular the role and relationship of the media to our movement, whether that includes new media or old, mainstream or black media specifically. We get to reflect on where we've been, where we are going, and the weaponry that is required. Tonight's conversation is a real privilege in that we get to listen in on a yarn with some of our nation's leading activists, each of which have made a profound contribution to the cause in different parts of the country, in different contexts, and using different mediums. I would like to thank each of the panellists for coming together from across the country for this conversation, and I'd like to encourage you, the audience, to join in on the conversation afterwards, or join us online via the hashtag Blacktivism, as we are live tweeting tonight and they'll feature on screen. I want to acknowledge in the house Miss Rihanna Patrick and Mr. Davey Thompson and Jasmine, who are upstairs live tweeting tonight for us. I'd also like to encourage you to stick around for the films tonight at 8 p.m, which include a documentary about the 1982 Commonwealth Games protests, a special screening of Basically Black, which will be introduced by Dr. Gary Foley, as well as Barbecue Area, which is one of the earliest mockumentaries made in this country. I sincerely hope you enjoy tonight's conversation, and I hope that it affirms or inspires the blacktivists amongst us. I'll hand over the deadly cards, Lisa Wadigo. Thank you.
Thanks, Chelsea. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. You all have in your... You should all have a copy of all the bios, so I don't think... I'm not going to spend much time talking about each of our guests, apart from saying, on my left, immediate left, we have Professor Gary Foley, Professor Gracelyn Smallwood, Amy McGuire, and Mr. Luke Pearson. Mrs. Amy McGuire, sorry. And Mr. Luke Pearson from Sydney. I want to just to basically set the scene for this evening. As Chelsea said, we're being recorded live on Periscope. Hi, everybody. So if you don't want to be recorded, then just, I guess, don't ask a question in the question time. because the screen's facing this way, not that way. But definitely, if you have a question that you would like to ask, we're going to have a specific question time at the end at about 7 o'clock. And then, but if you have a question or a comment that you would like to make during the course of the following hour, you can use the Blacktivism hashtag and we should be able to pick it up on the screens in front. We may not be able to pick up everybody's comments and address them, but if we can and if they're relevant to the discussion at that time, we certainly will. Thanks, everybody, for being here. It's wonderful. And this is, I think, this is a very timely conversation. When I used to teach at Griffith, and one of the activities that we used to do in our part of kind of our introduction activities was this communications exercise called the heart transplant exercise. And we had the students would be given a list of patients, and each person would be like a 32-year-old female with 5 children, and she's a lawyer. And then you go through all of these, and then there'd be, you know, an 84-year-old man who was a plumber. And there was always at the end, there was the Aboriginal activist, 24 years old, and fit and healthy, otherwise fit and healthy apart from needing the heart. You'd have 8 people, 8 patients, 8 different types of people from all different kinds of areas of life, and we had 1 heart. And the students would have to say who would get the heart and why they would get it, but who wouldn't get the heart. And nobody, you know, I used to do this exercise with hundreds of students, nobody gave it to the Aboriginal activist. And I'd say, why? Why would you not give it to this young, fit, 24-year-old man who has his entire life ahead of him? Oh, well, he's a dull bludger. He doesn't work. He's not contributing to society. And my... And I would say to them, he's probably a... He could be a journalism student. He could be a working journalist. He could be a community worker. That was for me what an activist was the kind of person who was out there in the community, engaged, doing stuff, being involved. It wasn't somebody, the students had this idea of what an activist was, and for me it was so far removed from my experience of activism. I'd love to ask, how do we understand what an activist is? We live in a kind of different world than one from the 1960s and 1970s. Gary, how do we define what an activist is? Do we have this stereotype, and how does it fit the stereotype, or is it completely different?
An activist, to me, is a conscientious objector to just about everything they see around them. I mean, a society is still... In fact, society is in a far worse state today than it was when I was 17 years old and when I got the fire in my belly. And I really can't understand why a lot more young people today aren't developing the same fire in the belly. I suspect it's because they've been deliberately conditioned into not thinking that way, which has been part of the government project that's gone on for the last 30 years. I mean, the activists of the late 60s and early 70s gave the Australian power structure such a fright that they devoted an enormous amount of energy into diffusing that the intensity of that feeling that was around then. But, I mean, anybody today who has even the most basic understanding of the history of Australia, or any sort of political history, which sadly most don't, if you do have any sort of sense of history and understanding of history, I can't see how you can't be a political activist determined to change the world around you. I mean, the students I teach these days at Victoria University, my main message to them, first and foremost, that look at the world around you, analyse it, understand it, and understand very clearly that it is possible still to change the world. And I say to them, when you go out and you change the world, just don't make the same mistake as my generation made. And my generation's mistake was that we actually did change the world, but we took our eye off the ball and the bastards changed it back on us. So when you change the world next time, folks, make sure it stays changed. Don't let the... No, I won't say that.
Amy.
I guess I see it growing up. I guess this is the other generation, and I think it was very successful what Gary was talking about, because I guess you grow up feeling, not personally, but activist comes with a really bad negative connotation. And I don't really understand that, particularly in my own work in journalism. You're not supposed to advocate. You're supposed to be unbiased. You're supposed to be objective, which is really ridiculous, because all journalism is biased and it's coming from a certain worldview. So I have no problem calling myself an advocacy journalism, because I think that's what journalism is supposed to be, particularly Aboriginal journalism. It's supposed to be about fighting for rights and never backing down and holding power to account. So I don't know where this idea that activist became a bad word, because I would agree that it's what you're supposed to be doing, especially considering the current political climate in relation to our mob. I mean, it's just getting worse and worse. We need people out there on the streets, but also in the boardrooms, I guess, at every stage, at every level, in journalism, in every sort of, you know, even in our health organisations, in our community-controlled organisations all around the country. We need it there. We need to reclaim that word, I guess.
And Grace, do you think it's got maybe something to do with the sort of some kind of negative connotation around what a radical is?
Oh, well, the last two speakers have covered it. You know, when they label you as an activist, you're really kind of like an outcast. And if you never had activists, both black and white, and advocacy, we'd be all going bloody crazy. But yesterday I was at a meeting, a HIV meeting, and everyone was being very conservative about it, and I just jumped up and talked about the stats and said, we're talking about Indigenous closing the gap when to be black in this country, it's an underprivilege, and to be white in this country, it's a privilege. Mm-hmm. And someone said, Grace, you've got a bloody chip on your shoulder. And I said, I've got a forest on my shoulder. And it's not going to go away till our black babies are dying at the same rates as white babies, until our incarceration rates are the same rates in every spectrum you look at in this country. And they talked about our people having diseases yesterday that some developing countries have eradicated. So it's like a lot of our people, black and white, have gone to sleep. And I wrote a letter to the government saying that the activists in the 60s and 70s that fought for our community control services, if you look at just about every community control service in this country, they're dominated by white employees, and the board of directors are condoning that, and the whole spectrum's changed. We've got more money today than we've ever had before, and the statistics are getting out of hand. So people need to get out of their little cosy homes and cosy whatever they're living in and start being active, because if we don't continue to be active, the future of our children is not going to be good.
I think it's also people need to see what is happening around them, and if you look around you, you see that there is a vast amount of government money and a lot of energy being put into what I call diversionary programs. In other words, recognise this campaign to have constitutional recognition, which is a load of nonsense. You know, the possibility of getting a referendum vote similar to 67 today is bucklers and none. So the whole exercise is completely pointless. It's not going to go anywhere. It will never happen. And yet a lot of really good people are putting an enormous amount of energy and money into this ridiculous campaign. And while they're doing that, the attention of the Australian people and of themselves is being diverted from some of the really serious issues that confront us, like what Graceland just mentioned. The incarceration rates in this country are unbelievable. You know, almost 30 years ago, we had a Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody. The number one finding of that Royal Commission was that the reason so many Aboriginal people were dying in jail in the 80s was for the simple reason there were so many Aboriginal people in jail. And the primary recommendations of the Royal Commission were designed to prevent Aboriginal people from going to jail at the rate that they were. They weren't going to jail because we were bigger criminals than anyone else. They were going to jail, the Royal Commission found, because of the fundamentally racist nature of the Australian criminal justice system. Now, that was 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago. Today, there are more Aboriginal people in jail than there have ever been, much more than at the time of the Royal Commission. How much debate in the public sphere in Australia is going on about that? Virtually nothing, because everyone wants to talk about recognise, some nonsensical proposition that will never get up, but, you know, it diverts people's attention from the real issue, and it enables right-wing publications in Australia, like the Australian newspaper and most of the Murdoch press, to talk about nonsensical other things, divert people's attention from the real issues that are major sort of problems for the Aboriginal people. And so that's one of the reasons why I say that things are worse today than they were when I was 17. And yet and they're going to continue to get worse.
And I think you picked the perfect example when we're talking about the relabeling of this word activist, because when you look at the way recognise is being framed, it's a top-down government organisation, very well-funded by government, and yet it's being called grassroots. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see the propaganda being pumped up in relation to that and the use of language to actually demean and sort of push back mm-hmm. the actual true activism out there. And we're seeing this completely uniform sort of coverage around recognise that completely silences the really important and cynical feelings amongst the majority of Aboriginal people around constitutional reform, but you never hear about it. It's this uniform view across mainstream media characterising it as grassroots, and they've just used that term and, you know, said they're, I guess they'd be termed as activists as well, and it's as far removed from a grassroots organisation as you can get. So when you're talking about the relabeling of these terms, I mean, I think that's the most perfect example currently.
I want to emphasise the point about this recognition stuff so that people are really clear what I'm saying. I'm saying that the chance of getting constitutional change today is buckless and none. If you look back at the 67 referendum, I'm a historian, I can tell you about the 67 referendum. In 1967, that referendum came about at a time when there was massive support in the broad Australian community for the proposition of justice for Aboriginal people. It came at the end of a 10-year concerted campaign by people such as Faith Bandler and Kath Walker and an army of the old guard activists of that era, an intense and highly organised and brilliant campaign. It came at the end of that. Now, in excess of 90% of the Australian people voted yes in that referendum, which enabled that constitutional change to happen then. Since 1967, we've had a phenomenon which came from up this way, out at Ipswich, in a fish shop. Where a red-headed woman come along and changed the landscape. And through Pauline Hanson and John Howard, Australians were given permission to be racist. Now, the nature of Australian society today is radically different to 67. Therefore, the chances of getting a referendum to pass on any issue to do with Aboriginal people is buckless and none. And even if you could get that referendum up and through, what will it change? What will mentioning us in the Constitution do in terms of reducing the incarceration rate? What will it do in terms of addressing the vast issues of injustice, the enormous health problems that exist in our community, the whole gamut? It won't change the slightest thing. It'll make a lot of white people feel good, and that's all. So yippee, let's go for the referendum, folks, you know? It's a nonsense. So there.
So, Gary, you mentioned in the... Yes, yes. But, so, moving on. But you mentioned in just talking before about talking to your students, if you can see how the world... If you can see what's going on in the world, surely you have to be an activist. And yes. Go on,
sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, the topic of this... this seminar or this evening is the world is watching. It makes me wonder, are they actually watching? I might hand it over to
I've
Luke.
I've got to believe that change is possible. I've got to have some level of faith in the Australian people to enable me to keep going. If I don't, then I'll go and jump off a bridge or something. I still believe that there are sufficient people in the Australian community who've got some sort of an understanding of the issues of injustice, inequity that pervade Australian society. It's a question of Aboriginal political activists in Australia today doing what we did in the late 60s and early 70s, and that's forming alliances with like-minded groups within the Australian community and battling a way to bring about and effect change. But all of this requires people to have some sort of analysis and understanding of the nature of Australian society, how we arrived here at this point in time, the structures and you know, the
So that's about communication.
It's not about communication, mm-hmm. It's about knowledge and understanding and awareness of history. You know, I say that because I'm a historian and I believe that people can't make any sense of what's going on in Australian society today without at least some basic analysis and understanding of how we got to where we are today. And the majority of people in Australia that I encounter, and the majority of students when they first come into my classes, know bugger all about any of that. In fact, it still appalls me that kids who come into my classes fresh out of high school they actually know less about their own history as Australians than I knew when I came out of high school in the 1960s, for heaven's sake. And the nonsense they taught in high school in the 60s was so bad that the only subject that I failed in 1964 in the New South Wales school certificate was history, you know? And yet I came out of high school with a better understanding of Australian history than the kids who arrive in my class now. But it only takes me 3 months to turn them around, one semester, and I can do wonders for them. And they leave my class with a better understanding than virtually everybody in this room. So come and study with me, folks.
Teacher of the year. Luke, you're a school teacher. Nice segue.
Well played. Smooth.
So many of you will know about Indigenous X, which started out as a basically Twitter account.
Yeah.
Do you want to have just talk us through this whole idea of I'm interested in we have a very filtered view of the world if our whole world comes from social media. You can filter it so that you shape it into the things that you like. If you really like cats, you can spend your whole life looking at bloody cats.
And a lot of people do.
A lot of people do. How do we open that world up? How do we make it that the world is watching and understanding and learning, doing the stuff that Gary's talking about?
Yeah, and I think there's a core group on social media, and obviously I'm a big advocate and a big fan of what social media can achieve, but at the same time it's painfully frustrating at times and there are massive limitations to it at the same time. And, you know, some days you feel like it's... We're just another TV channel for a lot of people out there. You know what I mean? So one day we'll be talking about, like, seriously huge issues where you just think, how could you be thinking about anything else when you're looking at a death in custody, some horrific thing happening in government, whatever it is, and then 5 seconds later everyone's talking about My Kitchen Rules or whatever. I don't watch TV anymore, but, you know, Big Brother, whatever the TV show is, they've moved on to the next one. And so they're interested in something for that moment that it's in front of them. And then they move on to that next one. And that really frustrates me in terms of you see everyone coming together for that 5 minutes and it's like, if we could sustain that 5 minutes for 5 days, we could probably do something. But it rolls on so quick, so often. And so I think, you know, a big part of it, like, there's a lot of people out there who come with that, you know, 101 student attitude. Like, we want to know, but we know nothing. And they're good people. You know, you can flick them resources, you can give them references, you can have a yarn with them, you can get them to where you want to be. But there's obviously that hardcore right-wing group on social media who just spread that constant, you know, misinformation about it as well. And
isn't that right-wing a little bit different to the way it used to be? The right-wing is I'm not racist, I don't see colour brand now of right-wing.
Oh, yeah, they're very, very feel-good, and I think that's a big part of the change of what, you know, was being yarned about earlier with that. It was easier to know what was going on. There were clear good guys, bad guys. There was goodwill for stuff. Now the people who claim to have goodwill are the people taking all the funding. Mm-hmm. You know, where you can have a mining magnate be held up as a champion of Aboriginal people, where you get all these white fellas all seen as you know, mad saviours because they go, I like black people. And it's like, that, I don't even know what that means. And how do you get $100 million for saying that? But I think with so much of it going on, you know, a lot of that goodwill gets filtered into those wrong places because there's so many things up there going, oh, you know, if you like it, come sign the pledge for Recognise, come sign the pledge for Racism Stops With Me, come do something that won't actually do anything. And when you're sitting there going, no, guys, we've actually got to do this, and a big part of it is you've got to change the way you're thinking. We can't just throw that racism's over party, you know, that yay, pat on the back, your good white people party, which is, you know, the apology, Recognise, the bridge walk, so many things out there that it's just like, can we be done with it now? And it's like, no, we freaking can't until we actually do something and we change stuff and we put in assurances to make sure it ain't going to happen again and again and again. And, yeah, social media is awesome, but I think we're still a hell of a long way away from actually getting to that point where we need to be.
Yeah. Amy, you're in... How many of your peers take the explicitly activist role that you do with your work?
I'm not sure, actually. I know that, I guess, in relation to journalism or...
In journalism, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe people do it a bit less overtly as me, but I feel like I've had a bit of a luxury in the sense that I've always been able to work for independent media, except for maybe Newswalk, which is sort of independent. But I think a lot of young, upcoming Aboriginal journalists, unfortunately, are absorbed into a lot of those disempowering structures of mainstream media. So they feel that they have to... they become assimilated into these news values. And you see it even in the way... I mean, even in our own Aboriginal media spaces, even just the language people use. For example, we still have Aboriginal media calling the Palm Island riots. And I'm always amazed by that because as... mob, we shouldn't be using that word riots. It wasn't a riot, it was an uprising, it was an act of resistance. And that actually really, it's not true. I mean, it actually promotes lies. So I think I've just had a luxury of being able to work in a structure that's completely independent. But I feel that a lot of young Aboriginal journalists coming up are trying and are going to keep trying to do that and to push against it and to take more of that activist role in relation to journalism and change the way that journalism is actually reported in this country, because I think Aboriginal journalism fundamentally plays a completely different role to mainstream journalism. And a lot of the time you're not just holding the government accountable, you're also holding mainstream media accountable. Mm-hmm. You know, big media like News Limited, who are directly complicit in the oppression of our people. So that's another role that they have to play. But I feel like there's a lot of young Aboriginal journalists who are growing up and doing that. And are going to start challenging that.
Hey, Grace.
Yeah, I guess you can't burn the hand that feeds you because a lot of our media, black media, has been chopped in half, like a lot of our organisations. Our AIS funding, over 80%, went to non-Indigenous organisations, and it's very difficult for them. But when you talked about the Palm Island... death in custody, you're spot on. You know, we've always called it resistance. And then when you see black journalists saying the riot, because it just feeds into that cone of racism of mainstream media, the same as the intervention, you know. They had to suspend the bloody Racial Discrimination Act to implement the intervention that said all our black men are paedophiles. The AMPs, the alcohol management plans, were so similar. And that's because we don't have a treaty or a Bill of Rights. But then the activists, and I must say hello to some in the audience, Brother Sam and Auntie Jean, there's heaps of others here, because, you know, we're just a couple of us or four of us here. But we predicted that once the intervention occurred, and it was and the AMPs, that there'd be a massive epidemic of amphetamines, and that's exactly what's happening. But... getting back to Palm Island, where my father was taken away and sent there under the infamous Protection Act, it was crystal clear that people went to sleep. A young brother just sitting on the side of the road singing Who Let the Dogs Out, selling crabs. He offended the PLO and Hurley, you know, they take him into custody, and 1 hour later, I mean, he was seen as a healthy young man. His injuries were horrendous, you know, a split liver, busted portal vein, fractured ribs, and then all this saga that went on, the evidence was crystal clear, saying that these injuries occurred from a fall. And if that happened from a fall, we should be banning bloody rugby league. Mm-hmm. And an all-white jury not only let Hurley go free, every one of the police officers that were involved in the case got bravery awards, and Hurley was transferred south and was given a promotion. And that would not be tolerated. Mm. And look at what's going on in America. Sure, they've got the numbers, you know, police shooting young black men. And people have gone to sleep in this country. Mm. You don't have to have thousands and thousands. It worries me when millions and millions of our dollars are going not to poverty, are going not to the grassroots level, when you've got conservative black and whites kind of ticking and flicking, saying everything's okay in this country. Well, it's not okay. And until everybody wakes up and smells the roses, we're in deep shit.
What role does media... So what role does media play? How, as people who are owning, who are working in new media, Luke and Amy, you're kind of old media but new as well at the same time, how do we wake people up? How do we wake folks up? Like, what the hell is... What's going on? Where is everybody?
I actually don't know, because I was just thinking and talking backstage. I'm really frustrated by just how circular this debate goes, and people just swim in circles, and a key example of that is this, you know, narrative we're talking about family violence. And mainstream feminism is still falling into the same traps. They're still not listening to Aboriginal women, and they're talking about this 30, 40, 50 years ago. They've been talking about this for a very long time. So I think it is that understanding of history and trying to educate, but also understanding that all of the disadvantage and all of the poverty that exists in communities all stems back from that original invasion. Mm-hmm. And you just can't understand anything in Aboriginal affairs until you understand that. That everything, every generation has been affected, there's been compounded trauma, and that's a really complicated thing for white Australia to understand, because it involves confronting their own prejudices, and it involves confronting so many other things, and the fact that they're beneficiaries of stolen land. And I don't think Australia, sometimes I think Australia's not even ready to come to grips with that. So I think it's breaking down that barrier as well. And I think even amongst, you know, the left, who I guess are... I write mostly for New Matilda, so it's a leftist website. People still don't understand. They still want to tell blackfellas what they should be offended by. They still want to talk down to mob. So they still don't even understand their own complicity in that struggle and what's happened since that original invasion. And it's really hard to educate people who don't want to be educated.
I agree. I say to people in my classes, the non-Aboriginal people, the Anglo-Australians, you want to know what the biggest problem that confronts Aboriginal people in Australia today? It doesn't live in our communities, the biggest problem that confronts us. It lives in white Australia. It's called white racism. And I say to my students, if you want to do something for the poor little Aborigines, which a lot of... When I was teaching at Melbourne University in the education faculty, I used to say to the student teachers, I used to say to them, I know that most of you in this class are desperate as soon as you can to race off to the Northern Territory to find yourself some real Aborigines so you can help the poor little Aborigines. I say, don't. Simple. I say, if you want to help Aboriginal people, first of all, you don't need to go to the Northern Territory and find, you know, Aboriginal people in situations of deprivation. Just go a mile from this classroom out into the western suburbs of Melbourne. You'll find Aboriginal people there. But the real problem that confronts Aboriginal people doesn't live in our communities. It lives in your community. You want to do something for us, go out into your own community, go home and find yourself a racist. Go and find yourself a racist. I say to them, it's not difficult to find a racist in Australia today. All you have to do is go home. Go home and raise the topic at the dinner table. Go home after this class to dinner table and say to your parents, or say to the people sitting around the dinner table, I'm studying Aboriginal studies with Gary Foley. And you'll find you're racist. And when you find you're racist, the challenge is then for you to well, the challenge is to challenge their attitudes. And if you can't change the attitudes of somebody who you care about, somebody who means something to you, somebody who you love, if you can't change the attitude of that person who's close to you, then don't think that you're going to be able to do anything for us going out and trying to change, you know, going up to visit the Northern Territory to help the poor little Aborigines. I've seen thousands, over the last 40 years, I've seen thousands of little, well-intentioned, earnest white students go racing off to the Northern Territory to teach in Aboriginal communities. They spend a little bit of time up there, learn a few languages, learn a few words in the language, get a skin name, and they come back to suburban Melbourne and they skite amongst their mates. They're the experts in their local community, you know? And look at the education situation in the Northern Territory. Has it changed? Over all the years and all the thousands of little earnest white teachers have run off to the Northern Territory. What's the state of Aboriginal education in the Northern Territory? Up shit creek. So you ain't doing anything good up there. You go to the Northern Territory, the only person you're helping is yourself. So stop deluding yourselves. Identify the real nature of the problem and go and do something about it. And mercifully these days, a certain percentage of my students do that, which I'm grateful for. And they're the ones who are ultimately going to begin to bring about some sort of real change in the Australian community today. But you say to white Australians, well, the problem is white racism. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear bullshit about recognise or how you can go and help the poor little Aborigines in remote communities. One thing quickly, though, while we're talking about media, and because we're in Brisbane, I want to say this, that those of you who don't know, the first professional Aboriginal journalist in Australia, and to this day one of the greatest Aboriginal journalists who ever lived, was a man called John Newfong. He was one of the great Aboriginal writers. Yes, a legend, you know. One of the great Aboriginal raconteurs, a genius. He taught me more than I can ever, you know, repay him for. He was the resident media genius at the Aboriginal Embassy. It was in large part because of his genius and his knowledge and, you know, vast knowledge and his working in the mainstream media that helped put the Aboriginal Embassy not only on the map nationally in Australia to create that vast understanding, but also internationally. And John Newfong is one of the greatest Aboriginal activists who I ever knew in my whole lifetime, you know. Sure.
So some of you may not know that Gary Foley created the Koori History website. Did everybody know that one? It's actually the first Aboriginal space online in Australia and the entire world. So it's the oldest Aboriginal space online on the web. And I totally recommend it. And one of the things I want to... I guess probably my last question is you've collated this amazing website and all these amazing history resources that we can access. So there's kind of like no excuse apart from our own apathy. What do we do going forward? What my question to each of the panelists is, how do we move forward? We've got this massive 200 and something years of history and of activism. I think the first Aboriginal newspaper was like in 1837, the Flinders Island Chronicle. You know, so we've got history of Aboriginal media, we've got this history of Aboriginal activism. What do we do moving forward? What do I say to my kids or my grandchildren? What is it going to look like in 100 years' time because we've done it right? That's a big question, I know. Grace.
I was
speaking
Gary to answer that one.
Sorry. What have we done it right?
What are we going to do next? What's the future look like? What advice do I give to my kids?
Look, we need them to get off those bloody iPads, and and really seriously get our kids motivated in terms of because what our mob have done is given our children everything we didn't have, and we had nothing.
Yeah.
And so that I'm not saying they've all got to be poor, but you got to you know, even my grandchildren, you know, I've got 10 of them, started telling them about the deaths in custody, and this is where your grandfather lived. We couldn't get a house because we were under the floor and fauna house. We lived in a tin shack. Not just we, every black family in this stinking country. Mm. And the mind boggles to some of them and said, what? You know, and I said, we used to go around looking for bottles and copper wine. Not just we, all the black families, because if you weren't on the mission with the rations, you starve, because our women were not allowed to get any Centrelink or social securities. And it's just unbelievable at how that this conspiracy of silence of our true history has been kept so downtrodden, and the conservatism of politics in this country. They don't have anything like New Zealand, where there's a Maori party, where you've got... And it worries me too, if we get an Aboriginal party, we get all of the mob that have just found their Aboriginality. And so, you know, that worries me too. So you're asking me, where's the answer? You know, I've got non-Indigenous peoples that I went to school with that were white, and now they're Aboriginal. And I'm thinking, what is this going on here? And it's actually worse than South Africa. And, you know, South Africa learned by our Protection Act. So we got to keep pumping our kids, you know. We got to get to the dinner table and start telling them about, you know, they don't stop watching Days of Our Lives, stop watching all this bullshit when they're shaking around with no clothes on X Factor. See, you got to start... And we're so proud of our black role models. Mm. When we see deadly black faces, they're our role models, because our kids and all of us were so downtrodden. To be black in this country is still underprivileged. Not much has changed. And we got to even get to the conservative people and keep pumping it, because the true history in this country cannot be suppressed, as Brother Gary said, you know. And we would never think that people coming from the grassroots would become doctors and professors, you know. And because you get the conservative ones that say they fella's got a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
And the grassroots people, as I said, we've got a bloody forest on his shoulder. And every white person that we can talk to, the young whites, they're horrified. When I was teaching in Toowoomba, I asked the young, and two places never voted for us, Toowoomba and Townsville, said to the white students, they were up in arms when we made it compulsory studies, and said, you go home and ask your fathers and your grandfathers how they acquired their land. And then when they changed the Mabo legislation and watered down to native title, and then everyone's fighting, you know, 10-point scam and all of that stuff. And they were starting to ask questions to their parents. And, of course, the Vice-Chancellor was then getting into trouble, because the Vice-Chancellor allowed compulsory Indigenous studies. He's asking me where to now. If we can convince one white Australian about the true history of this country, we are winning the battle of us coming together and closing the gap.
Mm. Okay. Luke, what's your one piece of advice?
God, I'm usually more of a cynical bugger, so I always struggle with that in 100 years. And I mean, I think, we're talking about the obvious truths and what we all know to be true. And so when you're talking about what does justice look like and what does that future look like, this is a armed invasion, forced occupation that's ongoing, end of story. We don't really expect us to be given that sovereignty in a way where we'll have decision-making over the whole country. But I think if we can get to a point where we've got decision-making powers over ourselves individually, collectively, and the right to do so that isn't infringed. And then, you know, for the big part, though, on a personal level, like I'm, you know, about to become a dad for the first time, and sometimes it just scares me endlessly on so many levels, but I just think, you know, if I can take them to the places I went out bush when I was a kid, if I can tell them some of the stories that my dad told me, if I can tell them the history of what happened before us, and we can just keep that hope alive. I think more than anything, I don't know if we'll ever get to that point I was saying about where we should be, but I think if I can just make sure I don't pass on, you know, that inner cynicism I have to the point where they've gone, there's no hope. I think when we get to that point, it's game over. So I think as long as we can keep that alive, then we're in the game.
Yeah. Amy?
I would say I'd really love to equip our next generation with those tools to be able to
analyse the propaganda that's been constantly just, you know, it's just totally coming towards them because they're living in a completely different time. It's really hard to find out the truth, and it would be amazing if we raised a generation of children who were able to call out what they see. And I don't think we would have spent the past 5 years around a constitutional reform debate. We would be talking about treaty, which is what I hopefully, you know, see as the future. We have to finish, you know, we have to deal with this unfinished business. We have to deal with a final settlement. And I would really love to equip our next generation with the tools to be able to do that, to look at language and realise when they're being lied to, and find ways to question that.
Yeah.
In terms of technology and activism and media, I don't necessarily agree with Grace and wanting to remove all the iPads. One of the great lessons that John Newfong taught me was how to utilise and take advantage of each new advance in communication technology. Back in the day, at the time of the Aboriginal Embassy, prior to the Aboriginal Embassy in 71, when we had massive demonstrations occurring all over Australia for Aboriginal land rights, in those days we wanted to get the message out about a demo. My first lesson in technology was given to me by John Newfong and Faith Bandler in the office of Focazzi and Bathurst Street in Sydney, where they had an old Roneo machine. Anyone who's under 50 won't know what that is. An old hand-operated Gestetner machine that printed out pamphlets one at a time. Then you'd fold up those pamphlets, you'd stick them in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and you'd take it down to the post office and post it out. That's how you got the word out. Now, today, I mean, it blows my mind knowing that the technology there today, I can press a button and I can talk to someone in England, in South America, instantly. Now, if with the capability you've got, with the communication information technology you've got today, I mean, if we had that back in the old days, we would be running Australia today. So the challenge for young people today is utilise that technology, but utilise it not in a way so that you're looking at, you know, taking selfies of yourself and stuff like that. Think about the possibilities, the communication possibilities, the organisational possibilities that exist in that new technology. The reason I put together the first Aboriginal website in the world was when the first computer came out, I was thinking along the same lines as John Newfong always taught me to. You know, I started off with the old hand-run Gestetner, then the electronic Gestetner came in, then text machine that you could do these little bits of tape and you could put out 10 press releases simultaneously to 10 different media outlets in Sydney. Then, you know, each advance in technology, I was there on top of it. And then when the first computer came out, I thinking, just like John Newfong taught me, I got one, and the first thing I did, I took it to pieces and put it back together because I wanted to know what it was and how it worked. And in no time at all, before the internet existed, when all there was an old dial-up possibility, and the only thing out there was bulletin boards. It took you, you know, 2 hours to download a 6K picture. I downloaded technical manuals from these bulletin boards and I taught myself computer programming so that by the time I went to university as a mature age student at Melbourne Uni at the age of 45, one of the subjects I did each semester when I was going to university was computer studies. And so eventually I acquired the knowledge and that's how I built. I wrote all of the codes. I wrote all of the codes in my, and I still do to this day. And I don't do it in these newfangled what you see is what you get programs. Mm. I still write HTML code, and I write that, and that's how I do my website. But it's important that not to fear the new technology, but realise the possibilities that exist within it, and think politically about those possibilities. Because if you're a young person today, you know, the technology is there for you to change the world, folks. So go out and do it.
Look, I agree with Gary. I didn't say completely bloody we'll get rid of the old thing. But, you know, and I know you're running out of time, but
right.
The reason why quite a number of whites don't want to be on our side, they found a gold mine and they're getting a lot of money
to help the natives. And it's a real worry. And we're asking governments now to have a look at how much money is going into these organisations and also into the government, the institutions. There's been more of our babies being removed since the Bringing Them Home report. There's been more deaths in custody since the 1989 Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody and the Miller report. The education system is just terribly... Every bloody document, it's not rocket scientists to close the gap. And people don't want to close the gap because they're becoming very wealthy on our people's poverty. And so, you know, we've got to all have a look at that. Have a look at... Somebody said to me the other day, I work for health service, I didn't know anything about what the National Aboriginal Health Strategy was. That's pretty scary. You walk into some of the health services... Some people that have started the services, they don't even know who they are. They've got to know history, as my brother Gary said, and the white fellas have got to know the true history. Now, we've all said that, but I'm hoping people go home with the fire in their belly and say, we've got to get back into the ball game, because we're getting old now, 64 and over, and it's just a luxury for us because we're dying 20 years before bloody 60 of diseases that developing countries have eradicated.
Most of the people who were our... generation
are gone.
Are gone, you know. I mean, there's just a few of us left.
And some in the room.
You know, and that it really hurts me when I think about how many of those fantastic, good, staunch people who contributed so much in the old days, they're no longer with us. And most of them are people who you won't even know their names. And that is the greatest, you know, tragedy of all. It's important for you to know who went before, know what they did, and learn from what they achieved, and acknowledge and recognise them, you know. There's too many false heroes out there that the mainstream media will promote to you. Forget them. Go and find out who the real people who did stuff in your community are, you know, and try and sort of build on whatever they were trying to achieve in the day. Because there's another thing about most of the... As a historian, I can sit here and say to you that every generation of staunch Aboriginal political freedom fighters up until my generation, every single significant person who was amongst all of that vast number of people in the past, every one of them died paupers.
Yeah.
In my generation, I'm seeing for the first time people who are dying with a lot of money. People who are dying as millionaires. And that's criminal. I don't believe my perception of Aboriginality excludes the possibility of somebody dying with a lot of money and a lot of resources. That's not Aboriginal way. If you're an Aboriginal person, you, as Chicka Dixon used to say, you care and you share. And if you care and you share, it's impossible for you to die a millionaire. You know, an Aboriginal millionaire is a contradiction in terms. And if I could be, you know, really a smart ass, I'd also say, just like an Aboriginal Christian is a contradiction in terms. Oh, I won't go there.
That's a different conversation.
Yes, no.
Thank you.
That was Uncle Gary Foley, land rights legend, I guess, an historian from the Victorian University, ending that chat, part of the Clancestry Conversations, which was a series of, I think, three or four conversations held last week at QPAC here in Brisbane, centering around blacktivism. So I hope you enjoyed the show this morning. You can catch up later on 989fm.com.au. And that's us for today. I hope to catch up with you tomorrow.